If you enjoy Astronomy FM Radio, please let us know with a small donation. We do rely on your support, and it's true. Every little bit counts.
AFM. You're listening to AFM Radio on astronomy.fm, around the world and beyond.
Arr. Coming up next, it's time for an AFM Radio original program, Space Pirate Radio, brought to you by the Voice of Astronomy MIDI. This is astronomy.fm.
The pirates are coming, the pirates are coming, the pirates are coming, you better watch out.
Arr.
Arr.
It's Space Pirate Radio time. Buckos here on astronomy.fm radio. It is another Wednesday evening, and this one just happens to be January the 11th, 2017, at about a minute past 9 o'clock in the evening, so that would make it January the 12th, 2017, at 2 o'clock in the morning, Universal Time. So that means we're live for the next hour or so, and of course that means we have our Space Pirate Radio chat room wide open for everybody to come on over and join us. Two ways to get in here. Just go to the homepage. You'll see where it says radio chat. Or type in astronomy.fm/ in the chat. You get to the login page, and you can join the crew here right now. We've got you and me. We've got Captain William Buck Rogers. It's nice to have another base captain here. Optronics, Black Projects, Plaid Joan, Evil Spock, Plaid Sister, Plaid Mac, and Aqua for you. A cup of grog to all of you tonight.
Indeed. Actually, it is, I believe, still in our time, some hot toddy day.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a nice excuse for some grog after the show.
There you go. All right. Well, glad everybody's here tonight. And as I said, welcome people that are here coming and going, so feel free to ask questions in our chat room. We'll put some links in there, talk about some articles, things that are happening in space and not in space, and stuff like that. Hot toddy, nice. I like grog.
Indeed.
Grog's better. Well, the sun is
boring.
Blank. Yeah, back to blank. Not much activity, except there still is some
coronal hole.
Yes, yep. Indeed, a small one. Spewing out stuff throughout the solar system, getting trapped by the Earth's magnetic field, pulling it down to the surface-ish, well, at least way up in the atmosphere over the magnetic poles, and lighting up the skies in the northern hemisphere, because that's where we have a lot more nighttime in the southern hemisphere right now on the poles. So aurora being reported all around the Arctic Circle or so. It looked like southern Greenland was about some of the best places, stuff like that.
Yeah, we even got word from our astronomy comrades earlier this week that during the sort of the winter holidays, which had seemed to be a bit dull, there was some auroral activity noted down around the 43rd, 42nd parallel, so that's cool.
Nice. Get somebody else in our chat room. Dutchman, greetings, Dutchman. We'll assume you're from the Flying Dutchman.
Yeah, welcome.
This is Piratey Night here. Let's see. Something below the sun's limb right now. Interesting.
I don't see it on the... Well, let me share my SOHO image here. So I shared the coronal hole one with y'all.
Okay.
And here is the real-time image of how the sun would look through a normal solar filter, and I'm not really seeing much.
Yeah, me neither. Even not much in the way of active regions, too. That usually shows up in extreme ultraviolet.
Right.
So not much going on. Say a little corona hole every once in a while, throwing some stuff through the solar system. We're definitely getting into solar minimum time. Not officially there yet. Still have to flip that the northern hemisphere sunspot magnetic field. That hasn't happened yet. And if you look on the magnetogram, you can see, well, you can see something in the north. The black and white is polarized light being determined by magnetic fields on the sun and which way polarity is going. The southern hemisphere has flipped, so we've got the white leading the black in sunspot regions, but it has not flipped in the northern hemisphere regions. And I believe it has to have both of them to flip. So this time around, we would have the white ones leading and the black ones following. And as far as sunspot polarization goes, When that happens, then we will officially be past solar maximum, or is it the official start of solar minimum? Something like that. But anyways, hasn't happened yet. Yeah, but they are definitely noticing some things, like more cosmic rays are coming in. The atmosphere is getting squished down. So getting definitely changes going on. All right, let's do a little rundown on what's happening with the moon and planets, stuff like that. Let's see, what is today? Wednesday?
Today is Wednesday for us. Okay. Venus is looking marvelous.
Mm-hmm.
Eye of the evening sky. Yep.
Greatest elongation on Thursday, 47 degrees east.
And it is impressive.
Mm-hmm. Full moon on Thursday also. Nothing special about that, but except
Mercury will be coming around in the morning before too long.
Mm-hmm. It's already starting to come around. In fact, greatest western elongation is going to be a week from Thursday on January the 19th.
Yes, and we may as well mention that. Yep, we may as well mention that now because next week, Marty and I will be unavailable.
That's true.
I will be off enjoying the palm trees of Southern California. Marty will be enjoying the dentist.
Exactly.
And so we will be running classic. So right now, mark your calendars if you want to check out Mercury in the pre-dawn light.
Yes.
Next Thursday. Good day for it.
As I usually recommend, the pre-dawn, that's nice, but if you just wait a little longer, even after the sun's up, you can pick it out in the sky with a telescope. It's not that difficult. So, yeah, I always try to promote daytime observing of planets.
And Mercury is quite bright. Nothing like Venus is right now, but when you do catch it, it's unmistakable.
Yeah, it's just kind of nice to get it off the horizon, so after the sun's up for a couple hours, it puts Mercury pretty much somewhere around the meridian. So it's well up, and if you've got some magnification, you can point your telescope just right. You can pick it out in a nice blue daytime sky. If you have a blue daytime sky.
Yeah, Michigan's not been getting a lot of that lately.
Yeah, it's either wet or white lately. Let's see. On Friday, Venus 0.4 degrees north of Neptune. So, yep, Venus and Neptune hovering pretty close to each other. We've got Regulus and the moon being really close on the 15th. So it's going to be an occultation. I looked it up. You have to be basically almost near Antarctica, the southern Atlantic Ocean, in order to be able to see an occultation of Regulus and the moon. So not a good one at all.
Yeah, not really well positioned, especially this time of year for Antarctica.
Yep. Major asteroids all over the place. Oh, let's see.
We had a squeaker yesterday. Up your alley, Marty. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. A near-Earth asteroid flew by half the distance to the moon. So, that was pretty close. It was just okay size, about 100 feet in diameter.
Yeah, it kind of snuck up on us. So even though it's not a very big one, it's gotten a fair amount of media airplay because we didn't see it coming.
That's right. It would have been a loud boomer, knocking out windows and things like that. And
it was about the height of a 10-story building, so maybe at its maximum about 111 feet across. And it was discovered by our friends at the Catalina Sky Survey 2 days prior to the flyby.
Oh, nice.
It would not have meant an extinction-level event. There would have been damage more along the lines of what happened over the Russian city of Chelyabinsk a few years ago.
Yeah, knocking a lot of windows out. Might have been a nice debris field, though. So, would be worth picking up some meteorites and selling a few of them to pay for your broken windows. That'd be a fair trade-off. We like to go to some of our astronomy events, and there's usually one local meteorite collector and seller there, and we always try to buy something from him. Kind of nice.
It would have been more dramatic than Chelyabinsk, but certainly not, asteroid impact mass extinction. That's not the kind of mass extinction we ought to be worrying about right now.
Exactly.
I'll just say that much.
Mm-hmm. No big deal. So since I'm looking at my star chart here, might as well see what's going on. Mars, Venus, and Neptune are actually pretty close together in the sky, just after the sun goes down. So those are pretty good, pretty close. Uranus and Ceres are actually kind of close together.
Mm. Nice little planet dance.
Yep, couple degrees apart. And what else have we got for planets? Getting up into, Gemini right now. We've got the moons in Gemini and Vesta's there too. So Castor, if you're going from Castor to Pollux, you kind of go right to Vesta, about 4 or 5 degrees away.
That's cool.
Nice run of planets. And, of course, our usual constellations this time of year, we get into the Orion area, Taurus, things like that.
Where the great winter constellation, so Auriga, very high.
I didn't want to say winter because it's not everybody.
True. Well, okay, the great January constellation. So Sirius, the brightest star visible from Earth, to our perspective, of course, since really it's not that large.
Mm-hmm.
But it's close, so it's very bright. It is never better situated in the sky than it is in early January.
Mm-hmm.
So Sirius is great. Procyon is great. If you are to the south of where we are, you should be enjoying lovely views of the second brightest star, Canopus.
Mm-hmm.
And if so, I am envious because it's a very pretty sight.
Mm-hmm. See, just setting towards the west, the star that everybody has been talking about, the very close double star.
Yes.
Atmospheric contact. I finally looked up its position. All news reports and stuff were saying it's in Cygnus. So I finally looked it up. You can look at Cygnus either two ways, as a swan or as the cross. Let's do it as the cross with Deneb at the top and Alberio at the bottom. And the three stars that go across, it's actually go from the center star to the right star and a little bit out a few more degrees. That's about where it's at. I've got coordinates here. Right ascension, approximately 19 hours, 29 minutes, with a declination of 46 degrees, 37 minutes. So that puts it right off the right arm of the Northern Cross. And it's listed as 12th magnitude.
And why do we care about this little 12th magnitude star, Marty?
Because it's actually two stars.
Mm-hmm. With
so close together, and I think they're, I didn't look to see if they're giant stars or what, but I think they are. They're so close together that their atmospheres are blended together. So you've got basically two stellar cores circling around each other, nearly in contact. In fact, they think they're so close to being completely in contact that it would only be a matter of years before the two cores merge together.
And we don't mean decades. We mean years. We mean
they're looking
possibly at 2022?
Mm-hmm. Maybe 5 years, something like that. I know it's hard to predict exactly, but, well, this is a little bit better than predicting volcanic eruptions. Because they can measure the orbit of the two stars going around each other, how long it actually takes. They can measure the increase in speed of the two things going around each other, and they can kind of measure their how far apart they are. So they can kind of do more of a mathematical educated guess on when the two should actually merge together.
Not everybody agrees with the model, but it is a plausible model.
Mm-hmm. And say not just a wild guess, but something with a bit more potential of, yes, actually having a merger. When it does merge, probably a kablooey. But I don't know if they're saying how much the two will.
They're predicting that this binary, if it merges, might have an outburst 10,000 times brighter than their current state.
Mm-hmm.
So, or based on previous models. So, with this one, we've got a 12th magnitude star, and we might get an outburst that hits, say, second magnitude.
Okay.
Which would make it easily visible, even from well-lit suburbia.
Yep.
You might not be able to see it in the middle of, say, Buenos Aires or Beijing, but, even in, say, New York City.
Mm-hmm.
You will see this thing if it does indeed reach second magnitude.
But second magnitude is not a look up and say, oh my, the world is ending because this star is so bright. It's casting shadows. Everybody around the world can see it. The world's going to end. No, it's actually about only as bright as the North Star.
Yeah, but or the stars in the Big Dipper, if it gets lucky. So we're not talking about something brighter than Venus currently is, which would be it's kind of a jaw-dropping, oh my, what's that?
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about there's going to be a new star, a red star, most likely.
Okay.
About the size of any of the stars in the Big Dipper, or as you said, Polaris, the North Star.
Mm-hmm. Trying to think of what, let's see, at 46 degrees, you can see it from fairly far south. Hopefully it'll be at the right time of year type of thing, of course. So, yeah, it could happen when, the sun's in that part of the sky, too. And we don't get to see it. Now, I will call this a amateur astronomer's type of star. So something that an amateur astronomer would be the one to be able to pick it out. So I'd say general public, don't know the constellations, will not be able to find this this star. Let me see. What's the one in the one closest to it in Cygnus? What's magnitude? Okay, that's 2.9. So basically, the Northern Cross will have an extra star off to one side, about equal brightness, a couple degrees away.
Yep.
Not easy for amateur astronomers because the Northern Cross, pretty easy thing to pick out. But I'd say the general public might not even pay attention that there's another bright star there.
Well, more likely they'll read very compelling articles talking about the red nova and showing them pretty Hubble pictures of red stars in Semana Saratus. Uh-huh. And then they'll go looking for that, and then they'll look up and go, oh, it's this. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So this is something that if it does happen, like several comets in recent years, there might be a gap between the hype and what your average member of the public experiences as the reality.
Right.
Doesn't mean it's not really cool,
mm-hmm.
but it's not going to be jaw-dropping.
Yeah. When it says red star, I'm thinking something more like the burner on an electric stove when it's on high and kind of starts to glow red, something like that. I'm not thinking fire engine red, blazing deep red, kind of like Mars is red, but it's not really all that red.
Right. Well, actually, it is... It has been suggested that Betelgeuse, the great red supergiant in Orion,
there you go.
Was caused by a similar merger.
Oh, interesting.
So it might be at least Betelgeuse red, which would be striking.
That's reasonably red. Arcturus is reasonably red. Antares is reasonably red, but not spectacularly.
Yeah, Antares is pretty good. I mean, and especially because if it's in Cygnus, there's nothing really comparable in that part of the sky. So that's where the great white stars of summer are. So you've got Deneb, you've got Vega, you've got Altair, beautiful objects, but they're all basically colorless. In fact, I think Vega is the standard for an officially colorless star. Looks a little blue to my eyes under normal conditions, but anyway, they're white. And so throwing a fairly bright red star up there would indeed be striking.
Mm-hmm. I've got a Wikipedia link to this. This is where I found the detail. Everybody else is trying to throw out the spectacular news hype stuff. So here's some
in Wikipedia. Sky Telescope has a good article that I've posted. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, this one's got the technical detail in it from Wikipedia. It's ray ascension, declination, apparent magnitude, orbital period, stuff like that. So we can get some. A little bit more technical detail. Let's go to Wikipedia. The name of the star technically is KIC 98-32-227. So if you're not in our chat room picking up links, and then that'll get you there. Or just look up the contact binary star in Cygnus, and that'll get you there too. Let's see if there any of our chat people. We got some more people in chat room. Kevin,
Optronics joined too.
Yep. Wasn't feeling very well earlier, he said. So it's good you're here with us tonight. I looked up the position of 45P also, the comet.
Ah, yes. How's it doing these days?
Honda, it's actually kind of low.
Yeah, it was pretty low last week, to be
honest. Yeah, and I tried looking for it. So to be up reasonably high, it's got to be like 5:30, which is really about sunset time, so way too much twilight in the sky then. So, it's one of those, it's going to be really bright, but it's also going to be in twilight, so it's not going to be that really bright type of comet. So one of those that are technically bright, but if you don't have dark skies, and you can't have dark skies because the sun's in the way, then it's not going to be that great.
Hey, Black Projects reports that it's been seen from Scotland, so that's cool.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Oh, yeah, which is, you know, 10 degrees more north of us.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I could not make it out with my tree line, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think. It's in Capricorn,
mm-hmm.
near Aquarius, I think it is.
Mm.
Something like that. Let's see. Where's? Yep, it's in Capricorn. And on the border of Aquarius, and let me zoom in on these stars where I was looking where it was at. Beta Capricorn is the best one to be your guide to that. And that is, Capricorn to me is kind of a triangle-shaped constellation. Not a perfect triangle, but kind of a triangle.
It looks a bit like a boomerang to me.
Think so?
Yeah.
I think it's quite, the top is kind of bent like that, but the bottom I think dips down more like a, you know, a triangle. So basically along the top edge of the triangle, kind of around the middle, that's where Beta Capricorn is.
Yeah, Capricornus is not known for its amazingly bright familiar stars, unfortunately.
But if you really look at it, you can pick out its shape. It's kind of a triangle with a point down towards the south is the way I kind of recognize it all the time. And, of course, that's right close to the sun because the sun is right next door in Sagittarius. So it's technically there. I haven't had a chance to see it or even to try to find it when it was a week ago or so when it was a little higher.
No, a little bit higher.
Yeah, just higher in the sky, not by its position amongst the stars, but just because of the way the sky has shifted over for the seasons. It was a little bit higher, but I was working a lot, too tired, and too cold out also.
Last week was bad, yes.
Yeah, so we've kind of warmed up a little bit here, like 10 degrees warmer, but it's also that rainy, cloudy type of warm, not helping astronomy at all. Oh, well. So keep trying for it. Got some more comets to look forward to. So it's out there. Maybe you have a good chance. You have a from the northern hemisphere, if you have a good southwestern horizon, you got a pretty good chance. No, an okay chance, I should say. If you live, let's see, what do we get? From the equator south, it's saying not visible farther south. I'm kind of surprised. That doesn't seem to make sense. Because where it's at should put it squared up a little bit to the sun if farther south you are.
Now, there's also the other comet out there, C2016U1 NEOWISE.
NEOWISE, okay.
Yes, which should be getting closest to the sun on the 14th of this month.
Okay.
Now, this, unlike the comet that we were just discussing, 45P, which comes around on a regular basis, this is a visitor from the fringes of the solar system, so it's not coming through regularly. And it's expected to reach maximum brightness this week, so it should be from the northern hemisphere. It can be seen in the southeastern sky shortly before dawn. And right now it's getting better, I would think, for the southern hemisphere because it's trucking. It's moving along pretty good, at a pretty good clip.
Yeah, this one's actually moving south. So this would be for us northern hemisphere observers. The sooner you see it, the farther north it is. Ophiuchus, that's like, yeah, that would have to be in the morning again, just before sunrise.
It's
so
morning,
lot of twilight. It's actually not that far from the other one from 45P. And it's actually getting closer to 45P as well. They're kind of switching positions. They're kind of almost like this one's heading southeast, the other one's heading northwest. And they're real close to the sun. Let's see, where is it at right now? Ophiuchus, which is just north of Sagittarius. It's kind of all in the sun region there, though. So, Well, give it a shot.
Yeah, it was anticipated to be a binocular object. So, we're again, something of pleasure to amateur astronomers, but not going to knock the socks off the public.
Yeah, even I think a tough one being this close to the sun. and twilight, not so great even for amateur astronomers. Unless it's really, really bright. They have to be really spectacularly bright, and they're just okay bright. So I don't know, this another one's going to be, these two are just going to be tough. Mm-hmm. Technically there, but you have to have some incredibly good clear skies. Those kind of, those like blue mornings when the sky is really blue. There's, you know, when you get either sunset or sunrise without all the white haze near the horizon, stuff like that. So you have to have some incredibly clear skies, good horizons too. You're not going to see it with a lot of junk around the horizon, trees, buildings, stuff like that.
So actually, definitely, for some of us who've had nasty weather sweep through, leaving a beautiful clear sky, give it a shot.
Mm-hmm. What have I got these on? I like cometchasing.skyhound.com. I'll put the, let me go back to the main page on this one. Here we go. I'll put this in. I usually type in search chasing comets, and that gets me there just fine. This one has a detailed star map, so you have to already know these constellations in order to be able to find it. The one that has a general general star chart, you know, basically it tells you what constellation it's in, but no detail, is Weekly Bright Comets. This is Chasing Comets. There it is in our. Oh, you put it in our.
I put it in, yep.
Okay. So if you get to see it, let me know. Take some pictures. Post them here in our chat room. Yes, we can actually see pictures that you post in our chat rooms.
Yeah, so since this isn't a live program, it's a chart, it'll give you at least an idea of whether or not you should even bother. So for instance, for NEOWISE, this particular NEOWISE comet, because of course there's many, it'll say visibility on January 7th. If you're at 30 degrees to the south, it wasn't visible. But by the 14th, for 30 degrees south, it will be very low in the eastern sky during morning twilight. Whereas anybody, say, at our latitude, for, 45 degrees north, nope, gone, out of luck.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the January 21st, week of the 21st, it'll be gone for everybody. So you really have a tiny window left to grab it.
Yeah. Captain Buck Rogers recommending the Sky Live. I'll have to check that out. Can you pop a link into our chat room for that? Flip over that and check that out. I like this one, Chasing Comets, because it has a nice detailed star chart, and you can actually zoom the star chart up and get bigger and bigger and bigger and get, you know, closer and closer detail. So you can really zoom in on the close by star. So if you want to do some printing, I'm still kind of a person that likes to take a printed star chart out into the field, because I can hold it up with a red flashlight and have my binoculars in one hand and the star chart in the other hand, and do some star hopping between the binoculars and the star chart a little bit better than, say, a laptop or a tablet. So I kind of like printing these out, because, and this one has a good detailed star chart, so you can basically zoom in on, like eighth magnitude stars. Let me click on, I don't know if that says what this is. You can zoom in on like eighth, tenth magnitude star or something like that, and be able to find them through first your 7x something binoculars, and then get down to the 20 power binoculars and really see some the stars, the fainter stars that are on the star chart will be on the basically in your 20 power binoculars, stuff like that. Kind of close to the Saturn Nebula, too. Oh, wait, this is 45 Honda, by the way. P45.
Yeah, another good thing about the comet chasing is that it gives you an idea of what tools to use.
Yeah.
So it's just flat. It says, okay, this one's going to be a telescope object. This one's going to be a monocular object. This one, yeah. How about not?
Yeah, good clues to figure out how faint of stars you can actually see at that time that low, too. So if you can find the constellations, you're doing good, actually.
Oh, all right. Well, I think we hit the bottom of the hour, Marty.
I think we did, and we are. Yes, so that means you are listening to Space Pirate Radio here on astronomy.fm. It is now 9:30 in the evening. January the 11th, 2017, for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America, universal time would be 2:30 in the morning. January the 12th, 2017. That means we've got still half our program alive, so if you're listening in, come on over and join us in our astronomy.fm chat room. We're going to put links to the things we're talking about in our chat room. You can also pick them up later if you want to on our Facebook page, Space Pirate Radio -astronomy.fm. So come on over. It's good to link into the Space Pirate Radio Facebook page, because before the show, I'll always say if we're going live, or at least I think that we're going live. After the show, we will put links in there, the same links that were in our chat room, so you can click on those and read the articles a little bit more in detail, figure out what we're talking about. And we'll also put our podcast there, too, so you can listen to the program anytime you want to. Instead of just the repeats, we will repeat this program every 4 hours for the next 24 hours.
And we do have a slightly different lineup following us tonight, Marty. So Astronomy Ireland is taking the week off.
That
so
is correct.
Right after our show, it will be Ask the Naked Scientists. And the question that they are going to be answering is Earth alive? And that will be followed, as usual, by Planetary Radio with guest Ben Miller, covering The Aliens Are Coming, the science behind our search for life in the universe. Followed by Naked Astronomers, followed by The Naked Scientists again, though this time they're reviewing the year in science.
All right. All that coming up right after Space Pirate Radio. And again, to reiterate, we will not be on live next Wednesday. You're out of town, and I'm going to the dentist, and I'll be probably in space, depending on the gravity. Well, we've had some NASA spacewalks.
Yeah.
Got one coming up again in 2 days, January the 13th. Let's see. NASA coverage is starting at 5:30 in the morning Eastern Standard Time for North America. Yeah, so that would put it at about something universal time. I don't know what. I think the spacewalk actually starts at 7 o'clock in the morning. So that's, what, 12 o'clock universal time, I think?
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. Okay. So you can tune into NASA TV, watch the spacewalk. There's been some last Friday, too. This Friday will be Shane Kimbrough and Thomas Pisca will be doing the walk this Friday. So check it out. I'm getting confused. I need to really go to one website that lists all of the future space missions and rockets and capsule names, and they keep changing everything, so I lose track. For instance, there's a orbital ATK Cygnus mission to the space station coming up in March.
Yep, supply run.
Okay, but they're also working on the, they're going to test the SLS's Space Launch System's largest fuel tank. And I lose track of who's doing the private stuff and who's doing the NASA stuff. I think SLS is NASA, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay. But Cygnus is what? And you get SpaceX and
Orbital Sciences. Okay. So SpaceX has the Falcon 9. Cygnus is Orbital Sciences.
Those are private companies, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And they've been servicing the. Both of them suffered some problems in recent years, so they both made the news for quite the wrong reasons over the last couple of years.
So I have not quite gotten it straight on who owns what part of it. Because the rocket's got a name, the capsule's got a different name, the company's got a third name. Like, I've totally lost.
That's always been the case. I mean, take a look at the Soviet program sometime, you'll get dizzy.
Mm-hmm. But that's okay, because that's all, you know, Russian language. I can't understand any of it. Too many initials for all these space missions that are coming up. Can't keep track of them all.
Hey, more space missions are good, right? We've got a whole
two
of them.
Yes, but all the rockets and the capsules.
Just asteroid missions alone. It'll be fun.
I just think it's confusing. And I'm into this. So what does the general public think when they hear this rocket and that rocket? And like, who is that? Isn't that all NASA?
Well, okay, so a lot of people probably approach things from a fairly, I'm not going to say jingoistic, but, you know, it, especially if you're, say, an American and you're used to America doing all the cool stuff, you probably have to be told, it's like, no, that's it. This is really cool, but it's a Japanese mission. Mm-hmm. This one's the ESA. No, that's not us. We help them sometimes, but this is what the Europeans are doing. And hey, there's a whole lot of private companies now, and they might be contracted to NASA, but they're not NASA.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, international collaboration and private public partnerships, that's the way things are right now.
Yep, that's fine. But they're just saying they're just a little confusing.
Like, okay, I was going to talk about the Very Large Telescope down in Chile.
Okay.
That is owned by the, that's a European telescope. It's the European Southern Observatory. So yes, it's in Chile, but the scientists are ESA scientists for the most part. Of course, plenty of people, you know, collaborate with them. So it's an international multi-functional arena now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just have to like find one website where it's all written down and in even order, and then maybe I can remember a little bit better that way.
But you can't just reduce it to some cute little spaces. Ooh, you know, USA versus the Soviets. Nope, different world.
Yep, that's okay.
That's great. A lot of cool things going on. Say, India. I'm really looking forward to what India gets up to in the next decade.
With Mars missions.
Yeah, they've got one up and running right now.
Yep. And Pluto missions and Saturn missions.
Well, somebody needs to get back to Uranus and Neptune, because NASA's sure not planning to anytime soon.
Ceres missions. And still analyzing data from Pluto.
Yes, indeed.
So even though the New Horizons, space probe, flew by Pluto. Has it been over a year now? I think so. And they got all the information, beamed it all back to the Earth. Now the scientists are going through that information and analyzing the features that are seen on Pluto. So they've got a lot of different areas. Now the latest, some of the things they're thinking, there might be some water underneath the crust in Pluto, describing different types of surface patterns. Yeah, there's actually not just lumps all over Pluto, but they come in patterns too. So what was it called? Blades or something like that.
Blading, yeah, bladed terrain.
Bladed terrain, yeah. So just patterns or ripples that they nickname. So not more data coming out of the space probe, but they're analyzing it and trying to figure out what the stuff actually means.
Meanwhile, New Horizons is on its way to somewhere else.
That's right. The next Kuiper Belt object. This one we heard at one of our presenters at our meeting mentioned this. Hubble captures a shadow play caused by possible planet. And when it was explained, I don't know, I didn't quite hear it right, but now that I've read the article, it makes much more sense. So check out this picture. You've probably seen this around a bit. This is actually a simulation. It's not the actual images of the star with basically a cloud of gas and dust orbiting around it. This is taking the data from the Hubble that looked at the star over a period of about 20 years and analyzed the data that they could actually detect a rotation in the material circling around the star, rotation period of 16 years. And they've noticed a dark part in the material. And they determined it was, okay, now some of the initial reports say from a planet. Well, not directly from a planet. There's a lot of dust and gas circling around the star. Now, it seems like there is a planet in orbit around it that is actually kind of pulling on the dust and gas, clumping it together on one side of the star. And so between the sun and that sun and the planet, the materials clump together in kind of a large cloud. That large cloud is actually shading some of the starlight from the rest of the debris farther out from the planet. So it's actually the simulation is showing a dark part in the inner region, kind of halfway around in the gas, and then same thing, a dark shadow in the outer portion of the gas and dust going around the outside of the star. So it's not the planet that's actually causing a shadow on the dust. It's actually clumped dust making a giant cloud that's shadowing some of the starlight onto the rest of the debris going around in orbit. Was a bit confusing every time I heard this. I had to really kind of read the article a little bit more in depth. And it's been a long project. Somebody actually like looked through Hubble data, 20 years worth of Hubble data, and looked up this star and found this information in the data. Of course, analyzed it, figured out what was going on. So, yes. So it's actually pretty cool. So, the picture, you know, you look at the picture, the thing's rotating. It's like, oh, look. Hubble can actually see this rotating and rotates around once every 3 seconds. And like, no, it doesn't work that way. 16-year orbit data analyzed over a period of 20 years of Hubble data. So even though the simulation is nice, but the real data is not like that. Oh, let's see. Got an article that I'm going to go ahead. I'm going to save one for, it's a black hole one. I'm going to save it for Friday.
Well, so speaking of models versus data, so for quite some time, the consensus has been that the most plausible mechanism for creating the moon was that in the infancy of the solar system, a planetesimal about the size of Mars smashed into Earth, knocked it to its current 23-degree tilt, and formed a big blob of debris that became the moon. Well, there's a new study out in the journal Nature, and it is putting out the idea that the moon didn't form from a single catastrophic collision between early Earth and the body that we call Theia, but from a whole series of collisions very, very early in the solar system's life. So they were looking at rocks from the Apollo landing. So remember, there's only been 6 manned missions to the surface of the moon. They were all back in the 1960s and 70s. It's been a while, but only a fraction of the rocks brought back have been fully studied. It brought back a lot of rocks, and they're kept very secure for the most part. And many of them have not been used for, you know, they're still sitting there pristine. So, looking at the isotope levels, this study found that isotopes of oxygen and titanium and tungsten were pretty much a perfect match for what's on Earth. So there's no trace of this material from the other body in these rocks. Now, of course, if you've got a model that involves creating the moon with one single impact versus one that might involve 20 different impacts, you know, one of them is more elegant. But if the physics is plausible, the the selenology is plausible, maybe the single impact theory needs a relook. So I'm sure other people are going to jump on that, hopefully study the rocks, and we'll see where it goes.
Good reason for pulling the rocks out.
Yeah.
And start to do more analysis on them. I remember when that wasn't even, the impact wasn't even a major theory. It was basically the moon and the Earth formed at about the same time out of the spiraling dust clouds that formed the solar system. And the impact theory was actually a kind of a radical idea, but it started to get proved in a couple of different ways. And now it was more acceptable, but now they're switching to multiple impacts, which I think is quite more likely because, well, there might have been like one major impact and a bunch of smaller impacts because it's pretty chaotic time, early part of the solar system. And not something that you could really nail down to one event for almost anything. Planets were smashing all over the place and flung out, changed orbits, some got closer to the sun, some got farther to the sun, constant bombardment, smashing together. In fact, it might even be kind of hard to determine like, for instance, how many impacts there were. Kind of like, you know, hitting, you know, breaking pool table balls, billiard balls. You know, you first hit the first one, it hits two, hits more and more. Then they bounce around and hit back into each other. So without, just by a quick look, it's really kind of hard to tell how many impacts there were, something like that. And I think that's kind of the way the beginning of the solar system was too. Hard to define anything specifically. You got to accept it's just a lot of impacts and a lot of changing. Let's see. Oh, some people say it was Theia. Now, was Theia the original Earth-y body? Is that what they're saying? The was impacted by Theia, or it was Theia that was hit?
Theia, and I've also heard it pronounced Theia in one of those things that seems to be kind of a U.S.-British divide over astronomy terms.
K with a K or a letter G?
T. It's T.
P? T?
Yeah, it's the Mars-sized body that hit the Earth.
Okay. Theia or Theia?
Yeah. Or I've also heard Theia with the hard T. Yeah.
I think it's the Ea. How about that? The Ea.
The
T-H-E-I-A.
Let's not go with that one, Marty.
The Ea? Yeah. Or we could just call it Bob, like a radio director suggests. All right. Let's see what else we've got coming up. We've got about 10 more minutes or so. Let's see, we did some observing. Well, I do recommend getting out to observing. Well, we've got a full moon coming up, so we're obviously going to be losing deep sky observing this week. So mostly planets and asteroids and the sun, or look at the moon too.
Well, speaking of light pollution, there was a nice story in the Washington Post this week about the success that a city in Arizona has had in keeping its night sky dark. So Arizona is, of course, critical to U.S. astronomy because of the number of important telescopes located there. You know, you've got the Lowell Observatory, you've got the U.S. Naval Observatory, you've got Kitt Peak, among other things, the Callia Sky Survey operates out of there. So a whole lot of critical telescopes are in Tucson, Flagstaff, places like that. And so this was a nice, happy story about combating light pollution and keeping the light dome down, and definitely worth a read, particularly if you're active in your community and trying to get the light pollution under control.
Okay, I'm looking up the International Dark Sky Association right now, which is at darksky.org. I'll put that into our chat room. Kind of a subject that I think is kind of faded recently. It's not so much in the public eye, so it needs to come back. Everybody's thinking, well, the lights are getting so much more efficient now. We don't have to worry so much about light pollution. No, it actually can get worse because the LED lights are
full spectrum.
Full spectrum. They are more efficient. They're more directional. They can be aimed a little bit better, so less goes up, but they're also cheaper.
Which means people can do a lot more of them.
Yes, add them up and up, add more. And so even if you don't have light shining directly up into the sky, the bounce off the ground will actually get worse. The old inefficient ones, because people worry about the electricity use anymore if they're a lot cheaper to use. So you still have to get out to the public that, yes, cheaper lights is not necessarily better. They still have to be toned down a bit. They can't be quite so bright. They have to be aimed properly, not used all the time. A lot of lights are just left on, blazing away when they're not even being needed. Parking lots being lit on all night long that they never did before.
From a public safety perspective, as many studies have borne out, the idea that more light leads to everything being safer is, it's counterintuitive, but it's wrong.
That's correct. Okay, so maybe you won't trip over a car with over a curb with more lights, but as far as crime.
Yeah, no. if you're worried about being carjacked, that's
more,
not
more
the right way to go about solving it.
That's right. More lights won't help. In fact, like in residential neighborhoods, a lot of crimes don't occur in the middle of the night. They occur in the middle of the day when everybody's working and nobody's home, so it's easier to break into a house when nobody's home than when somebody is home in the middle of the night. So you don't, and everybody's in the middle of the night is sleeping. You don't need those lights blazing outside so much. just enough lighting. And sometimes blazing lights actually create shadows that are hard to see into. It can be worse that way. So it's really more about proper use of light, lighting up backgrounds, leaving the foreground dark so you can actually see farther into something. So you can see, basically, you can see shadows moving in front of a light a little bit better that way, as opposed to a light shining on something, the way that type of lighting works. So, yes, try revisiting the International Dark Sky Association. I put it in our chat room. Checked out their website. Figure out what they're doing. Try not to overuse cheaper LED lights. More is not better. And try to think about more efficient ways of using lighting. And convince your local city to do the same thing, too. You got to start low. Start at your own home and work your way out to your community. Even if you just give general presentations. Usually your city council allows a certain amount of time, like 5 minutes, for basically anybody to speak on any subject. So just throw that out there at least once a year. Say, hey, if you're thinking about a lighting project, try to be more efficient. It doesn't mean add more lights in the middle of the night. The city I used to live in actually had a double lighting system. They had old-style post lights, kind of antique-y style, and basically a single pole with a big light globe on top that just shone everywhere. And they, I don't know, it was because of that or because of the, what do they call those, cobra head lights. They actually had both types of lights.
Yeah, we have quite a mixture, particularly since my neighborhood that I live in, it is a historic neighborhood, and they're very proud of their old-fashioned light posts that evoke the era in which the homes were built. So we're talking 1919, 1920.
Yes, back when there were gas lamps at about...
actually the area that we live... Because Marty and I are from Metro Detroit. Detroit was a pioneer in electrical lighting.
Mm-hmm.
Arc light towers that once lit up downtown Detroit can now still be seen down in Austin, Texas. So they're still functional. But they're very cute. They're adorable. The light pollution is terrible. And we've got those supplemented with, on the major streets, new modern white light LEDs.
Mm-hmm. So the idea is lights should not be made to look at. So when you actually, you're walking down the street and you can look at the light, that's bad.
Yeah.
Light should be shining on where you're going. And a lot of people think, oh, yeah, let's just make them brighter. That'd be better. Brighter is better. No, brighter is not actually better. Not even for what they're intended to do. You can actually get so much glare coming in, so much light coming into your eyes, it actually makes it harder to see at nighttime, the way your eye works. So it's really a matter of efficiency. So, yeah, because your eye, well, let's just do a little eye biology here, that most people know that the pupil of your eye actually gets bigger with less light entering it, so it allows you to see fainter things. So at nighttime, if you shine a lot of light into your eyes shrink down. They can shrink down 4 or 5 times. So that means by having more light go into your eye, directly into your eyeball, that you're actually making things 5 times dimmer on the ground.
Right. It is amazing what the human eyeball can adapt to. And it's a little difficult as we all get older. You know, many of us who are astronomers wish that we could have the eyes that we did at 16 in terms of simply letting in light.
Mm-hmm.
But once you're out there on the observing field, if you've ever been in a dark sky site observing, you realize even under a moonless sky, you can see a surprising amount. You give it, say, half an hour, and suddenly you're fine. You're not tripping over your own 2 feet. You can see details. You might not be able to read without bringing out a little red flashlight.
Mm-hmm.
But you can certainly figure out, you know, what your eyepieces are, maneuver your gear, not trip over your own cables, that sort of thing. And yet one person breaks out the white light flashlight and suddenly you can't see anything.
That's right.
For a good 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm. I've noticed it with the stars, too. When you're in kind of a brighter room and you come outside, the sky looks really dark. It's like, oh, you can see some stars, but the background sky is really dark. So, oh, this is great. And then your eyes get dark adapted, and what happens is the background gets brighter and brighter and brighter, and you find out your skies really are not that dark. Interesting effect. But same thing on the ground for, you know, being outside. It's like, yeah, if you have light shining directly into your eyes, you're actually seeing less light that way than if it's just shining on the ground where you need it. Oh, about three more minutes. What have we got left here?
Were you going to bring out the black hole story, Marty, or were you saving that for Friday?
I'm going to save that for Friday. Yes, I found a nice black hole story, so I think I will save that one for Friday. There's something we haven't covered tonight. I think there was, but can't remember what it was.
Gotcha. No pyramid stories tonight?
No pyramid stories tonight, no.
That's okay. I won't torture you with any Bigfoot stories either.
Any what stories?
Sasquatch stories.
Sasquatch stories. Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, I hate those big time.
I know it. I know it. That's why I save them when I come across them. Hey,
go ahead.
So just a little bit of, I mentioned earlier that the Very Large Telescope down in Chile is getting an upgrade.
Okay.
The reason is that it is going to be looking at Alpha Centauri because we want to study the recently identified exoplanet, Proxima B.
Mm-hmm.
So given the interest in Alpha Centauri itself, it's always been, you know, one of those things that since it's the closest big star to us, we think about, you know, could we get there? Who lives around there? Now that we know that there's a planet, that's very exciting. So it's going to be probably a thing closely followed compared with many of the other exoplanet studies.
Okay, cool.
Don't know what we'll find, of course.
Yeah.
No promises.
All right, here's one for our chat room. A study showing that the farthest stars in our Milky Way galaxy are most likely ripped away from another galaxy.
Oh, that's not surprising. Milky Way's gobbled up quite a few things over the aeons.
I know. Like, we've heard this kind of story quite a bit before, and I kind of wonder, like, why is this such a new story? It's like, it shouldn't be. It's, yeah, something we've heard quite a bit before. Yeah, pretty much the outer stars, or a lot of actually dwarf galaxies are being torn apart by the Milky Way galaxy. It's thought to have happened quite a bit in the past. It's thought to continue to still happen. So I don't know why they call
it. Well, it looks like they've identified quite a few of these as coming from the Sagittarius dwarf galaxy, which is interesting. It's always nice to know the Milky Way's murder victims, you might say.
That's right.
So that's what happened. But some of them are not, and so they haven't pinpointed yet where they originated from, which is also kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. So I put the article in our chat room, and again, it's out there all over the place, so you can find it in
your favorite. Yeah, it's got some pretty models to look at. Yeah. So we'd like to thank everybody who joined us in the chat room tonight. Nice, lively crowd. They were having a good discussion about water on the moon while we were finishing up tonight.
It's like water everywhere throughout the solar system.
It is. It is amazing, Marty. When you consider what I was taught in high school 20 years ago versus what we now know, it's a wet world out there. Wet worlds everywhere.
Everything from the possibility of polar craters on Mercury.
Yep.
In fact, that seems to be like the hot spot, if you want to say it that way, cold spot of finding water and cratered planets is in the polar craters, because sunlight doesn't actually get all the way down to the bottom of those craters. And we know there's been lots of comets, watery comets, traveling throughout the solar system and have hit pretty much everything from Mercury to our moon. So anything that they've hit in the sunlight portions of a planet, obviously that stuff's been basically just vaporized away over the billions of years, but anything that's kind of landed in the permanently dark, cold craters probably still there, and they've been confirming that too by finding actually water ice in the bottoms of these craters. So there's potential of being able to actually go to these places. Nobody ever thought, well, we could go to Mercury. No way we could ever go to Mercury because wouldn't sustain anybody for very long. It's either way too hot or way too cold. It's like, well, they'd be able to get into those watery craters, which would be ice, by the way. And once we develop a system for converting those ices into rocket fuel efficiently, a little sunlight to help us out do that, we might be able to do extended stays on Mercury, maybe the northern or southern craters of the moon, too. So might find, you know, if they ever come up with a serious plan for a moon base, you might find that they will actually be more closely into the craters, the northern and southern crater polar regions on the moon. I'm thinking everybody thinks it's going to be like right in the middle of the our side of the, you know, face front side of the moon. I'm thinking, nah, not going to happen. 2 weeks of nighttime, 2 weeks of daytime, direct sunlight.
Direct sunlight's a problem. There's a reason that when we sent people to the moon, we sent them there in lunar morning.
Yes. The ground was just starting to warm up after being 200 degrees below zero. So they kind of calculated when the ground would be up around 70-ish degrees, 75 degrees or so. Won't strain the spacesuit so badly. So NEN didn't go there, you know, later in the lunar day, because then the ground would be staying warm for a long time.
High noon on the moon would not be pleasant.
Yeah, actually a little bit past that, because it, you know, after the ground
heats a while.
It's like a lot of times on the Earth, 4 o'clock in the afternoon is when it's the hottest, because the ground is, you know, spent all that time warming up and it's retaining the heat now instead of mostly warming.
Yeah, no, that's from what I've seen of the temperature curves. That's true of the moon and Mercury also.
So I'm thinking the moon would also have a little bit better radiation coverage in the polar craters too, not getting hit by
direct blasts coming out of the side of the sun. Yeah.
Yep. I'm thinking that too. So keep that in mind. You heard it here first on Space Pirate Radio if they ever get a serious plan for a moon base on the moon. And we could do the same thing with, well, water discovered in Ceres. In fact, right under, there's ices all over it and underneath its surface, all the way out to Pluto. Of course, the moons, Jupiter and Saturn.
No, I mean, it's like so many other things. I mean, when I was first getting into astronomy as a child, were black holes real?
Mm-hmm,
did other planets exist beyond the solar system? You had people seriously arguing, no, they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they were wrong.
Back when I first was getting into astronomy, galaxies were known to be galaxies, globs of stars, but a lot of them were still referred to as a nebula.
That is very true, and you can see that transition in books.
Yes, indeed, which I like getting the old astronomy books from as far back as I can possibly get and see how things have changed and how advanced actually astronomy was back then.
And that is why I am a diehard defender of calling the galaxy M33 by its real name, the pinwheel.
The pinwheel, sure.
That's the pinwheel. You can call anything else you want. The pinwheel M33 will always be the pinwheel in my heart.
I think I remember, wasn't it M101 was the pinwheel?
Yeah. 33? Yeah, it got booted, yes. There's now a different, M101, and now there's a southern pinwheel, too. So.
Yeah, to me it was M101 was always the pinwheel galaxy.
You can keep that one. I have M33. And that is actually enough for us tonight.
I think so. Again, thanks everybody for being in our chat room tonight. Don't forget, programs coming up after Space Pirate Radio.
Yep. Ask the Naked Scientists.
There you go.
They've got a big question about the future of the Earth.
All right, everybody. Enjoy the rest of your week. See you again next Wednesday for Space Pirate Radio. Good night, all.
No. See you 2 weeks from now.
Yep, that's right.
Yep. Bye-bye.
We hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is astronomy.fm radio.
AFM.